In today's video, we discuss the impacts of the Supreme Court ruling on affirmative action and higher education admissions. We explore what this means for minority applications. We also explore the direct and indirect impacts to diversity in the workforce and what changes this means for DEI and CSR programs. Let's make a social impact. Hi everyone, I'm Carl. Welcome to the Social Impact Show, a channel where you get the latest strategies and tips to help you scale and grow your CSR and goodness programs. So today, I've got a special guest. His name is Jerome Tenniel. He is the Director of Social Impact and ESG at the Uplift Agency. And today we're going to talk about, you know, in the realm of diversity, equity, inclusion, but really about the Supreme Court's decision on affirmative action that happened on June 29th or the end of June. And basically what it was, for those who don't know or just need a recap, is that the Supreme Court decided that, or to overturn a decades-long decision where universities could take into account race as part of the admission process, and they're no longer allowed to do that. So Jerome, what, in your opinion, what impact does that have on minority applications or even just admissions process in general?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, first, thanks for having me here today. So I think there are a couple of different things here, a couple of different layers here to this. And I will also just sort of preface all this by saying that, you know, the way that like affirmative action in the way that I sort of understand it as it's been applied to like university systems here in the United States, the way that it's been applied is that schools would have like a race conscious affirmative action in that they would use race as one of many factors in how they actually considered, you know, who was going to be admitted to their college programs. So that's very different than, say, having like a quota system that is like setting aside a certain number of seats for their applicant process. So I just want to make that's like my understanding of it. And so I think there are a couple, there are like direct implications, and then I think there are like sort of like the indirect ripple effects that might happen. And I think before I even get even more deeper into this, I'll just say like this is all speculation. I think realistically, when we're looking at like talent, like the talent pipeline, from high school to college and then from college to the workforce, right? Like you're talking about years. So there's a fair chance that we're not gonna see the results of this or the effects of this for years to come. But I think most directly, what it really means is that it'll immediately affect the decision in how colleges and universities will accept students. As they will no longer be able to consider, even amongst everything else, they'll just no longer be able to consider race as a part of the admissions process. Indirectly, I think the ruling could also impact how companies use race as a consideration in their hiring practice. And I think that, you know, when I talk about the unintended ripple effects that happen, is that the hiring and the workforce DEI goals that some corporations have may also, you know, I think there's going to be some implications for how corporations are engaged in this work, even though the ruling has little to do with the private sector.
Yeah, and you know, I really want to get into that perspective, because I think there's a lot of fallout that's happening right now. You've got, you know, universities. I saw an article today that universities are, you know, either removing or redefining their diversity statements just because they can't consider that, or, you know, even the perception of considering race into their admissions process. But also a lot of universities are either getting lawsuits placed up against them, getting sued because of their previous policies. But what's really fascinating too is, like, for example, Harvard, where I think I saw a couple of numbers where I think 34%, you know, it came out in court, the 34% or discovery where legacy students were being accepted over all other non-legacy students. So it's really bringing light, like the indirect effect of this is it's really bringing into the light admission process for all these colleges and universities, which is fascinating because I think, you know, when we're talking about this earlier, do you believe there's even a hint of maybe a silver lining where, you know, I think, what was it, like a couple of years ago, we saw the Felicity Huffman, Lori Loughlin, and the whole Varsity Blues scandal of the admission process. But really, is there a silver lining where maybe, hey, it's an opportunity for all these higher education institutions to maybe reset their admission process too?
Possibly. And what I'll just sort of say on that is I think it's going to open up higher education to greater scrutiny just sort of across the board in their admission in our admission process sort of at large. And one of the things that you sort of point to is there are some education institutions that have admitted students as a part of their programs based off of, you know, like, who do you know? What networks are you part of? Whose family are you part of? Are you, you know, are you within a legacy network that has been a major donor to the school? And so when I think about that, you know, obviously that is a very exclusionary way to admit students where, you know, it's just like, you know, wealth begets wealth. It's the privilege begets privilege. It just favors those who have the greatest socioeconomic privilege. And so, you know, I think there might be a little bit more scrutiny just sort of across higher education at large and how some of these schools are admitting students. You know, we know that there have been discriminatory practices within higher education. That one that you sort of point to is certainly one of those. And so I think there's a lot that's going to like shake out here. And it'll be interesting to see what happens. The one thing that I'll also share here, and this isn't, you know, what I'm about to share is not any by any means political, but I think there are certainly political implications and we've sort of seen that. And I think we're not going to see the dust settle on any of this until, especially here in the US, until after the 2024 election.
Oh, definitely. You know, and I might go a little bit off topic and then come back to it, because I think there is an upheaval in higher institutions right now. And there was a couple of people in the soft, I guess, higher education technology space that I was talking to, and where two things that, you know, really in a lot of presentations or on top of minds in these institutions, I think one is this, the Supreme, like, how does this impact, you know, admissions recruitment as well? And two is the impact of artificial intelligence and how that has upturned higher education in general. What I really like, you know, we had a conversation before, is how about the impacts, which I think, you know, brings to the forefront minority serving institutions, because I think, you know, like an HBCU, where I feel, and maybe there's probably a lot of people who don't feel the same way, is that the institutions like, you know, the Ivy League schools, where you get those networks with the impacts of artificial intelligence, with how things are a little bit, I would say, getting leveled. What is the, I think, like, those minority serving institutions have an opportunity here. In the broader scope, can you talk more about that?
Yeah, I think the one thing I would sort of share here is, you know, when I think about historically Black colleges and universities or other minority-serving institutions in the U.S., I think what we're seeing with this Supreme Court rule, you know, in higher education, it only really highlights the importance of investing in minority-serving institutions. Because, you know, if you're playing out this scenario, so let's say race is no longer considered as one of the factors that colleges and universities can use when they're admitting students. So theoretically, then you will have less diverse candidates who are entering colleges and universities, which means you'll have fewer diverse candidates who are graduating from colleges and universities. So now all of a sudden you have a situation where diverse talent is drying up for corporations, right? So as corporations are working with their university relations team And as they're going out to looking for, you know, their interns, and when they're looking for entry-level professionals and when they're doing job fairs, then, you know, theoretically, they're going to have fewer qualified candidates from diverse backgrounds to choose from. And so if you're in that position, then it only reinforces the importance of institutions like Howard University and other HBCUs, who have essentially been erected and founded because there were certain communities that were not getting a fair shot, right? So it really just further highlights the importance of companies and others like investing in minority-serving institutions, because, you know, if we play out that scenario, and if you have fewer, you know, less diverse talent at other universities, then like you can still matter factly get diverse talent through a minority serving institution.
For sure, for sure. And, you know, I think that's a great segue into how does this, and you touched on it briefly in your previous answer, was how does this impact the workforce? Now, I know we probably won't see in the next until for like at least 3 or 4 or 5 years, but what does that look like from a diversity hiring perspective, a recruitment perspective? Like, what does that look like? Because especially, you know, professions like law or medicine, where mm-hmm. those higher educations are requirements, like hard requirements, what does that look like?
So I think there's like multiple layers to this. I think, you know, but I've heard like the legal perspective, and I'm not a lawyer, but this is just what I've heard from those who are, you know, in legal counsel. Their perspective is that this reversal can also, in many ways, set a precedent or even open the door to allowing other people to bring other similar cases before the court, targeting diversity practices in other fields and other industries, right? And so that I can certainly see as problematic. And I think the sort of another impact to that is that of course, you know, this is all speculation on how this is going to like affect the workforce, of course, but it could actually affect the diversity of the pool of talent being produced by universities, as I sort of alluded to. And while we don't actually know what this is going to like look like, and we might not know what that's going to look like for some years, without universities having the ability to actually recruit racial minorities. The pipeline of diverse job seekers from universities may in fact dry up, as I shared. And if there's a decline in the college graduates, then of course, then that means, or that a decline in college graduates who are from underrepresented communities or backgrounds, then that talent pipeline that companies are looking for will certainly dry up. So we've covered some of that ground, but I would also say, and this is a part of that other ripple effect that I was talking about, it might actually embolden others to start to attack corporate DEI, right? Like people might see this passively and say, oh, well, the Supreme Court is reversing affirmative action on higher education. So now I have the permission from the highest court in the land to now start to attack corporate DEI. So at Uplift, you know, we're a full service sustainability and social impact consulting firm. And one of the things that we've seen across the ESG landscape is almost a reversal in how people are talking about ESG. Mm-hmm. And so there are certainly a lot of attacks, some of it politically based, but there are attacks on ESG programs. And I think just as we're seeing attacks on ESG, we're going to start to see attacks on corporate DEI. And so I think what that's actually going to do is the other trend that we've certainly seen across the corporate landscape is that companies are almost, they're reframing the language and how they're talking about ESG. So, you know, some companies are going from ESG and now they're talking about it as sustainability and social impact. Now, their programs remain the same, but they're removing ESG from any language because that's going to put a bullseye on their back. What we might see is that as attacks possibly ramp up against corporate DEI initiatives, it might be that corporations now have to reframe how they talk about their diversity and inclusion goals. If companies start to take a lot of heat, then it might actually have implications in how public and transparent they are with the goals. And I've talked about DEI quite a bit on previous episodes, but it's very common for companies to have like very set targets because there's a good amount of accountability and public transparency, and they have disparity goals that they're trying to close the gap on. So generally, they will have goals set around minorities and executive positions, board seats, manager, so like mid-manager roles and director roles. And every year, they will measure their progress in having greater representation, diverse representation in their companies, and they're very public about it. Some companies might start to shy away from how they're talking about it as a result of this, because they might be committed to the work, but they also fear that some of their stakeholders might see that as an opportunity to attack them on it.
Which, you know, when you say about the attack on ESG, and you say that there's a bit of a backlash on DEI, even people watching this channel, watching these episodes, what I've noticed is whenever we publish an episode related to ESG or DEI, we get a flood of comments, a lot of polarized comments with a lot against, and there's always people for. So it is a very fascinating, like, this has, like, those two terms have definitely polarized the landscape, and we can even feel it on just publishing episodes too. So is there anything that corporations or even CSR or DEI programs can maybe plan for over the next 3 to 5 years to either combat that or, you know, prepare for or have a different plan to adjust to that reality?
I think the answer is yes. And I think, again, there are a couple different layers to this. So I think, as I sort of think about this, obviously, in my opinion, there's a direct connection between, say, like public policy, government affairs work, and social impact. So it's really important, and just really understanding with like the general consumer, which I would sort of consider another stakeholder group of most corporations, having a finger on the pulse. So one of the things that I think, like I believe firmly, is that corporate responsibility teams who are engaged in social impact efforts, whether that's internally with DEI effort or whether it's more focused on, say, like racial equity funding and how they're placing their grants or volunteering in the community with specific organizations, you need to really have a finger on the pulse. And the way that you can keep your finger on the pulse is by always engaging and having a regular communication channel with your stakeholders. Your stakeholders, whether they're internally within the company, like your business leaders, whether it's your own employees across all the different segments of, you know, your traditional lines of business where you work, or whether it's different members of the community, leaders in the community, whether these are community members that might be more within the political sphere where your government relations team might have closer interaction with them, or whether they're just that your general customer. Having a good sense of sort of where they are at and the fluency in how they're understanding these topics is important. And also just understanding what their priorities are. Because once you're able to understand the priorities of all your different stakeholders, that's how you're able to navigate it a little bit more. So the reason I'm sharing this is because I think there are three things that are gonna happen. You're gonna have, on one hand, you're gonna have companies who are going to stay the course, and they're going to call it diversity, equity, and inclusion, and they're going to be brave and courageous, right? And I think there are some companies that have done that. On another hand, you're going to have companies that want to stay the course, but they're going to have to change how they talk about it because of their stakeholders. And so what I mean by that is some companies, they might decide to drop DEI and reframe the conversation away from diversity and really just talk about it as like their commitment to non-discrimination policies, right? That's another way to talk about it. And to just really double down on their commitment to like the Civil Rights Act. So it might just be that the second thing here is that through stakeholder engagement and just understanding what your stakeholders care about and how they perceive certain things, you might just decide to continue doing your DEI initiatives. And now it's just a matter of how you're packaging it, how you're communicating about it in a way that makes the most sense. And then I think the unfortunate part, this is the third one. There are some companies who are never committed to DEI. Those companies will just stop doing it. And to them, they're going to be able to fly under the radar. But I think, you know, to sort of get back to your original question, like what can CSR, or, you know, corporate responsibility professionals do? First, it's really understanding the environment where they navigate by connecting with their stakeholders to really understand their fluency on this issue, but then also the things that they most care about, and then navigate that expertly. And again, like CSR professionals, they don't have to do this stuff alone. That's why corporations have public policy and government affairs team, right? Because that team is going to help them navigate this politically. This is why they have crisis communication team. This is why they have public relations and a media team, right? This is why they have experts within their company who understand communications. I always say that communications is the new power tie. It's about understanding, listening, and understanding what the information that you're receiving. And then being able to package something in a way that will be universally or valued by the majority of people in a way that you can still continue doing all of your corporate responsibility, social impact work behind the scenes, but the way you're talking about it and packaging it is going to be met with less resistance because of the way that you talk about it. So that would be like my thing. I don't know if that was like, it wasn't like a checklist or like a very specific list how you plan for it, but I do think that corporate responsibility teams can plan for it. And I think it really first starts with understanding the environment that they're operating in so they can understand how to navigate that better.
And I can imagine this would have different impacts and different plans and strategies depending on which industry you're in, right? Especially right, if you're a law firm or you're in medical technology or working directly with doctors, would have a definitely different impact than, you know, maybe in computer science or in technology or, you know, trades. There's so many different ways. And like you said, we won't probably know the impacts for quite a bit.
Yeah, I would say that's true, right? Every industry and every company, based on their business model, they'll have different stakeholders, you know? Mm-hmm. And depending on the industry, your business model, whether you're publicly traded or you're a private entity, right? Those have massive implications on like what you can and can't do and how you need to future-proof your company and all the programs that exist within it. You know, and again, it's something that I think is going to be very unique to most companies, but you're right, it's going to differ depending on the brand and who they're affiliated with.
And remember, if you're getting value from this video, we'd really appreciate you hitting that like button. And the question for you today is, what do you think the impacts to the workplace would be because of the Supreme Court ruling on affirmative action? Let us know in the description below. So Jerome, I know we could probably talk about this for hours and days and weeks, but if any of our audience wants to connect with you, maybe have that conversation or learn more about the Uplift Agency, what's the best place to reach you?
Two different places. You can go directly to our website, theupliftagency.com, or you can find us on LinkedIn. And we have a newsletter that we publish twice a month, and you can subscribe and stay abreast of all of our events and our happenings.
Thank you for listening to The Social Impact Show. Make sure to rate, review, and subscribe. Then visit benevity.com to access some of the resources mentioned in this episode, along with tons of other insights to help you grow your program.
Music provided by Ikeson. For questions or topics you want us to cover, reach us at podcast@benevity.com. Until next time, be a force for good.